What I wanted to do tonight was to continue to talk about the six perfections, but I want to do it in a little bit different way. And the reason for that is that when we talked about the six perfections before, it sounds pretty highfalutin. I mean, get right down to it, you know. And it, in a certain way it is, but there's also something really very concrete and simple. And I kind of wanted to get more to that, because I think it's sometimes easy to not see how actually deep Buddhist practice connects to day-to-day life in very simplistic, down-to-earth, getting on with it kind of ways. I mean, there's a lot of philosophical stuff, and because of my nature, we tend to hear that, because that's just the kind of person that I am. But there are also things that are much more kind of down to earth, and so I want to share that with you, and I want to share that out of my own experience. So I'm going to kind of start with a story, but I want to give some context first. So the context is, we talked about the six perfections, of which there's the perfection of wisdom, and then the other five perfections, which are skillful means or artful means, which is to say more like, how do we behave in ways which promote our personal development, or development toward Buddhahood, if you want to use that kind of language. And another way of talking about the same thing is to say that the perfection of wisdom is about seeing things as they truly are. And the other five perfections are about acting in ways which are congruent with that truth. And what the truth is that everything connects to everything. Everything influences everything. Everything depends on everything. We don't tend to see it that way on a day-by-day basis. We tend to see things as being independent and disconnected and isolated. That's the way we see ourselves, most of the time, anyway. If you get sick, you might see things a little bit differently. You see how dependent you are on your spouse or the medical system or something like that just to survive. And there's an old Indian story of, if you really want to understand how dependent you are on what's going on around you, the teacher takes you down to a river and grabs you by the scruff of your neck and holds you underwater for a little while and pulls you out and says something about, have you noticed how dependent you are on the air? For every moment, you know, you got it? Okay, I mean, they're pretty concrete about that. A way of thinking about the six perfections, which is to say the path to Buddhahood, is to think about wisdom, which is seeing, understanding what's really going on, and artful activity or artful means, which is acting in the framework of that understanding, which is acting in a way in which you understand how everything is connected and how your behavior has impacts on things and arises in dependence upon certain kinds of things. Again, it sounds a little spiffy, esoteric. It's called dependent origination. And these are just two sides of the same thing, actually. Having said all of that, I want to talk about a way of understanding dependent origination, which is not intellectual, not cognitive, which is very direct, a way of acting, which is very down-to-earth, and yet still promotes an understanding of how things connect with each other and how people depend on each other, which is something most of us do every day, and I don't mean breathing, but something else, which is cooking and eating, which is kind of, you know, and it's interesting to me that we live in a country which has a superabundance of food, and aside from the fact that there are unusual numbers of people who don't have enough to eat in an incredibly wealthy country, one of the main problems that you hear about, especially among those who have enough to eat, is how come I'm not as skinny as I want to be because I'm eating too much? I mean, there's a lot of weird stuff that we experience in relationship to food, even though if you just sort of took a dispassionate thought about the whole thing, you'd say, what is going on and why? It just doesn't make any sense. But food is complicated for many reasons, so I'm going to step into complicated territory. But not so much just about food per se. So let me tell the story, finally, which is some years ago, I think it's now 16, 17 years ago, which is sort of astonishing to think of in itself. Kay and I were living in a Zen monastery, and we had come there because we'd been living in India, and I wanted sort of a situation for reentry, and this Zen monastery was in Northern California. I thought it was a good place to get my feet on the ground and get resorted out after going around the world for a year. And they said, glad to have you, and the abbot gave me a gig as visiting scholar. And I thought, that's great, because how cool is that? I get to be visiting scholar in a Zen monastery, and I get to sit around and read books and meditate and have a good time. And I got there, and the second day I was there, they said, so do you want to work in the guest house? Do you want to work in the fields? Do you want to work in the machine shop? Do you want to work in the kitchen? We'd put you in the library. That would be logical, but there are a bunch of other people already working in the library, so you can't do that. I said, what do you mean? I said, well, you know, the Zen tradition is if you don't work, you don't eat, so you're going to have to work. I said, I thought I was the visiting scholar here. And they said, you are in the afternoon, but in the morning you have to work. So where do you want to work? And I thought, I really couldn't see myself working out in the fields for all kinds of reasons, not least of which it was going to get really cold and wet out there all winter. So I put that out. Machine shop, I'm a klutz, and I didn't think I wanted a bandsaw having a close encounter with my fingers, so we would let that one go. I can't make a bed for anyone's business, so forget about working in the guest house. The last possibility was the kitchen. I thought, well, that's okay, at least I'll be inside in the winter. Yeah. So they put me in the kitchen, and the kitchen people took one look at me and said, we got our work cut out for us, because, you know. I thought, all right, I'll put up with it. So, you know, actually, it worked out fine. I got a book written, and that was part of what the deal was, so that was fine. But what turned out to be the case was the book was irrelevant to me. It didn't really make much difference. And what mattered was my experience in the kitchen. And it turned out that the best part of being in this monastery, shockingly to myself, was the work in the kitchen. And I came out of the experience with a real passion for cooking, which turned out to have some upsides and downsides. The downside being that when we got out of the monastery, both of us started putting on a lot of weight because I had a passion for cooking. But there was something that was going on that was very profound and very unexpected. So, I started with the usual kind of thing where that's food prep. They didn't trust me to cook anything, but they sort of trusted me with a knife and carrots. So I started cutting a lot of carrots. And of course, one of the things you learn when you're cutting up a lot of food, like big carrots, is you've got to pay attention. You've got a sharp knife, you've got a lot of carrots, and you've got fingers, and, you know. So in a certain sense, it's a very focused sort of meditation. And when you've got 110 people for lunch, you're cutting an awful lot of carrots for the stir fry. And so you get very focused. And the kitchen is a quiet place. There's no music. There's no talking unnecessarily. And everyone's just standing there doing their thing. And, you know, the gallons of carrots are kind of growing. That's fine. You know, you start getting your mind concentrated, and that's a good thing. But something else started to happen, and it started to happen once I started actually cooking food. It took a while before they let me do anything, but you think about this. You have soup for 110 people. It's easy to scorch it, and when it's gone, it's gone, and you don't have time to make it again, and everyone's really unhappy, and you know, so you don't just trust any old person to make whatever it was, 12 gallons of soup or something completely insane. But when I got into cooking, so I had been in the monastery long enough that something else started to happen, and in particular, a certain event happened, which kind of made me think about things a little bit differently. And there was this one guy in the monastery, and excuse me, I'm getting hot, so I'm going to take this shirt off. I mean, this outer shirt off. There's this one guy that drove me completely crazy. I mean, if you live in a monastery, there's at least one person that's going to drive you completely crazy. Probably a lot more than one person. There's this one fellow that drove me completely crazy. And he was working in the fields crew. And one day he came into the kitchen with this huge crate on his shoulder full of lettuce. No, excuse me, it was full of carrots that had just been pulled out of the ground in the field. And he walked into the walk-in cooler with them, and there was mud on the floor and all this kind of stuff. And I thought, as usual, I have this mess to clean up. And my mind got distracted by that, and then I thought, what? You know, what are you thinking? Why are you pissed off? What's going on here? I just sort of pulled back from that for a minute. And I kind of had got a different view of what was happening there. And I thought, oh, I can't remember his name anymore. But, you know, I saw the mud on the floor, which had been out in the fields, and the carrots on his shoulder, which had been out in the fields, and the carrots are now in the cooler. And I could see that tomorrow I was going to be dicing up those carrots that were going to go in the soup, and that everybody in the monastery was going to eat that soup, and that what was going to happen was their bodies were going to be soup bodies. That soup was going to become their bodies. And sort of like fields, mud, carrots, cooler, chopping carrots, sautéing carrots, eaten by Zen students. Zen students go in Zendo and sit and meditate. Soup becomes Zen. And I just sort of saw that connection. And I thought, well, I didn't actually think anything. I just sort of saw that. But it was kind of like light bulbs going off. Like, one thought was, how could you not have seen that? I mean, how can you be so dense? But we are that dense. We don't see that, you know. I mean, we don't walk into Safeway and look at the carrots and think of people in Mexico who are planting carrots. And we don't think of truck drivers, you know, bringing huge amounts of carrots. We don't think of the folks in our neighborhood who work in Safeway who are putting the carrots out, you know, in the vegetable part of Safeway. And the bookkeeper working in the back to keep track of all of this kind of stuff and the way the money is flowing around to make all this kind of thing work. We just go into Safeway and there's some carrots. We grab the carrots, take them home, chop them up, and do whatever we're going to do with them, and that's that. There's no thought about any of this other kind of stuff. The carrots are just there. They're independent. We look at them and they're just sort of independently sitting there. We don't see the whole sequence that brings those carrots to us, and we don't see the whole sequence of where those carrots are going. I mean, maybe some mothers make dinner for their kids and they really understand that the dinner becomes the kid, and so they really care about what they're cooking. And maybe they even think that the attitude that they have toward the food as they're cooking it has some influence on what's going on. Because one of the things that I noticed now, so now I've got this whole trail of carrots from field through mud, walking cooler into Zen students. One of the things I started noticing is that depending upon my state of mind, the soup tastes different. And it's not that I think the soup tastes different. It's that the Zen students think the soup tastes different. And it's not so much that they know my state of mind, but they have some things to say about the soup. Or more specifically, they actually had things to say about the salad. Because Green Gulch Farm Zen Center was on the coast of Northern California, and there are only certain things you could grow in this kind of field, which is next to the ocean, or these fields, which are next to the ocean. And that was stuff that grew in the ground, or lettuce. And if you're really good, you could keep the birds off the apples, but that was a real chore. So mostly what was grown was stuff that was in the ground or lettuce. And they grew the most amazing lettuce. It was all organic, of course. And one day, to get to this other side of things, one day somebody comes walking in with this box over their shoulder and it's full of all this lettuce. And the head's in the cool, and I'm looking at it thinking, this is really good looking lettuce. And the next day, I'm in the kitchen, and I pull the lettuce out of the cooler, and I put it down on the counter, and I'm looking at it. Now I'm thinking about Zen students working in fields and lettuce and so on and so forth. And I'm looking at it, and the lettuce starts to glow. I'm looking at the lettuce, I'm thinking, this is just full of life. It's not just a bunch of leaves, and it's like it's glowing now. You know? Wow. So we didn't cut lettuce. You know, we tore lettuce. And we tore lettuce and we cleaned it in this humongous sink and washed it off and washed off in water that percolated out of the ground at the Zen Center. We washed it off. And we put it in big spinners and we dried it off and then we tore it. And we'd make these bowls that would be, you know, this big. You can barely get your arms around bowls of lettuce because we have 110 people for lunch from the local Northern California community. So I'm making this, you know, and then making this, the salad dressing that's going on. And all the time I'm looking at this lettuce that's growing, glowing. And I'm thinking of all the Zen students. I think it's going to become the bodies of the Zen students and all this kind of stuff. So this is really what's going on in my mind. It's like, no, I have this meditation while I'm cooking, thematic meditation while I'm cooking on food and the origins of this food. And lo and behold, somebody comes in and they pick some nasturtiums, which are these nice yellow things that you can eat. So we wash up the nasturtiums and we put them on top of the salad. And the gong rings, we just get it done in time. And I walk out with this humongous bowl of salad. And half the people in the dining room stop and look at the salad and they go, jaws drop. Everyone can see the salad radiating. Everyone can see the salad radiating this kind of like amazing energy. Put it down. And it tastes fantastic, of course, because of all of this. So my frame of mind now is impacting the cooking. And so the food that's coming out of the kitchen is looking different and tasting different to people because of the mind that's involved in the preparation of food. And the mind that's involved in the preparation of the food is a mind which doesn't just understand where the food is coming from and seeing that kind of process, but also seeing that process with gratitude, that I stopped being pissed off at the guy who'd been driving me crazy who worked in the fields who brought the food to the kitchen now. So I was not pissed off at him anymore. He was just as weird as he ever was, but it was okay weird now. But I'm also thinking about where the food is going because I'm seeing how all this food is going to nourish the community. You know, we're going to have all these good, healthy Zen monk bodies. Then, at one point, one of the things that happens at a Zen center is they do these intensive week-long meditations where everyone basically, who isn't required to cook or something like that, is sitting in the meditation hall meditating for a week. And that's all they do. Except maybe they get up and walk in circles every once in a while to stretch their legs and they sit and meditate. This goes on for hours, for a week. Except for the people who work in the kitchen, essentially. Because somebody's got to cook the food, even if everybody's sitting and meditating. It's called a sesshin. And it's really knee-breaking. It's really tough and back-breaking and all this kind of thing. So my job was to work in the kitchen at one of the sesshins. And actually, I thought that was great because I didn't want to break my knees, to be honest with you. I was perfectly happy to work in the kitchen. And anyway, I was having this great time meditating in the kitchen because I got that that's really... I was learning about dependent origination in the kitchen concretely, you know. Not intellectually, like studying Nagarjuna intellectually, which is mostly what I've been doing up to that point, or even meditating on it, which had actually opened the door to seeing it concretely, because I'd been meditating on dependent origination and seeing these patterns around me, but now it's become a practice of slicing carrots and tearing lettuce and so on and so forth. So, okay, so now the sesshin is going, and I'm making food for the monks who were sitting in the sesshin. The monks is a generic term because there are many women as men sitting in the zendo. It's not just guys. So I need to be clear about that, just in case that was misunderstood. So, okay, so I'm going through my usual thing, and I'm being grateful for the food that comes in the kitchen, and it's glowing, and all this other good stuff's going on. You know, it sounds a little boring at this point. And I'm thinking, this is great, you know. All these people are sitting in the zendo, and what I'm doing is powering their meditation. And then all of a sudden, boing, I get, it's not just their bodies, it's their minds, too. So this conscious cookery is having an impact on their ability to meditate and turn their minds in a certain way, which is beneficial to them individually and to the whole community. And the nature of the community is not just the monks, as it turns out, because other people come into the zendo from the larger Marin County community. So basically what's happening is that my cooking is changing the bodies and the minds of all these people. So now I'm really very focused not just on where it's coming from, but where it's going to. Okay. And so basically what's happening is kind of an expression through my chop, 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 stir, 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 tear, tear, of the Bodhisattva vows of generosity and patience and so on and so forth, because I'm doing all this with the good intention of benefiting the minds and bodies of these people who are going to benefit the minds and bodies of other people through their own practice, and that the thing is going to be expanding geometrically, if you will. So then the last piece of that is the kitchen then becomes the meditation hall, and the pots and the knives become the meditation tools. And my whole attitude toward kitchens and even cleaning the stove and cleaning the pots and sharpening the knives completely changed. And the whole idea of a wet knife sitting on a counter, the knife starts looking like it's getting insulted, because the knife has a new character, because it's a tool which is assisting in this process. The pots become personalities, because the pots are the place where the food is transformed from what's not really edible to what's delightfully edible, right? And et cetera, and et cetera, et cetera. So I wanted to share that story with you and that kind of experience with you, because we all have opportunities to practice at a very concrete and very simplistic way this aspect of the Bodhisattva path, of the five perfections of artful behavior in the world, where we can come to understand a new kind of relationship with other people, with a new kind of intention to take care of other people through a very simple action. And it's just as profound as anything else. I mean, you can sit and meditate, and you can meditate, light rays filling the cosmos and benefiting all beings, and that's fantastic, but it's also intangible for us at our level of existence. It's somewhat intangible. But, whipping up dinner for your wife is very tangible. It makes her happy if it's well done. It makes her healthy if she's sick. So my chicken soup, I'm told, has curative powers. Whenever she gets sick, I can get large amounts of chicken soup. There's that. Yes. Yeah, I do have the Jewish gene for chicken soup. Yeah. It's not very Zen, it's true, because of the chickens in the pots. But it is what it is. Now, if we were to follow that line, of course, about cooking chickens, which you could do perhaps some other time, then we would get into some more kind of tantric imagery. I mean, I have a pot, which is a 6-gallon pot that I had been cooking in for 15 years now. This one, slightly beat up at this point, but generally speaking, beautiful pot. An awful lot of chickens have passed through that pot And I think about that when I take that pot out, you know. I think about what that pot looks like from the point of view of a chicken, by the way, and not just what it looks like from the point of view of a human being, which is a very different matter. So that might be something we could talk about at another time. But if you want to know very specifically what I mean about this, to see it in a very concrete way, if you go to Portland and you go to the art museum in Portland, just the Fine Art Museum, they have an extraordinary show on two floors of Native American art. And, you know, we think of seals as cute and furry and all that kind of stuff. But they have a seal in there that was sculpted by a native who figured out in some way, probably, what does a seal look like to a fish? And it's definitely not cute and furry. It really looks different. So if you want to see a real turnaround, if you're the kind of person that thinks seals are cute and furry, which I think they are, by the way, you know, or anyway, not exactly furry. They're sort of furry, but anyway, cute, right? Go look at the sculpture of what does a seal look like from the point of view of a fish, which is a very different matter entirely. So I don't know. We'll leave it at that point. Maybe we'll come back to this sort of conversation some other time about turning things around, looking at them differently. But the main thing is that pots and knives and frying pans and kitchens become what I would call a sacred place, a place of transformation, not just of food, but of yourself and of everybody that depends upon the food that comes through it. And if you take that stance, then although it doesn't sound like any cause and effect that we're familiar with, I also think that has an impact backwards in time to the people who worked in the fields, you know, to make those carrots and to drive those trucks and to balance those accounting books and whatnot. Because in fact, whether they knew it or not, of course they didn't know it, their efforts made my meditation possible. So there's some way that they benefit from the good deeds that I'm doing, even though they don't know it. I do think they do. And certainly my wife does, because my chicken soup makes her better. So I'll call it quits at that.